From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, what's the process to replace a member of Congress?
There would be no representation. The seat would be vacant until the election is held and certified.
Rick Pluta will walk us through that. Then our political commentators talk about the results of kicking the can down the road when it comes to paying municipal employee retirement costs.
And not really looking forward to the actual impact on the budget going forward.
We'll talk about kids who are troublemakers in school.
There's a trigger that we can't see that child is bold enough to respond to. And so we'd better wonder what that's a response to.
And should government work more with corporations to build infrastructure?
By any measure, the United States is a laggard when it comes to engaging in these public-private partnerships. Other countries use this to a far greater degree.
All of that and a cocktail. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The attorney for Congressman John Conyers held a news conference this afternoon to try to discredit one of the women who is accusing Congressman Conyers of sexual harassment. The attorney indicates Conyers will not resign. But this issue is not going away. Democratic leaders in Congress are still calling for his resignation. So if he's pressured further, or he's forced out through expulsion, which is very rare, who would represent Michigan's 13th district? To help us understand the process, Rick Pluta is here to explain. So, Rick, what happens if there's a vacancy?
In the event of a vacancy, the governor would call a special election to fill out the balance of the term, which would run until the end of 2018.
So there would be no representation until that special election?
There would be no representation. The seat would be vacant until the election is held and certified. And, it's not something that, you can just do in a couple of weeks.
So how long would that take to arrange?
Well, we don't know for sure. There's nothing that determines, in statute that says when the governor has to do it, although commonly it would be held in conjunction with other elections, and there are three official election dates on the calendar next year. And so the governor would have to make a decision on whether or not he'd want it to, to hold it like in the spring or maybe sooner. And then there are also just there are practical aspects of elections that need to be taken into consideration, that to run for Congress, any of the prospective candidates would have to gather 1,000 petition signatures to qualify for the ballot. So you've got to have time for that.
And that's been troublesome for Congressman Conyers in the past.
Among others, it seems to be a thing here in Michigan. So there's that. Plus, you've got to leave enough time, which is really a couple of months, to make sure that ballots get out in time to military personnel and other Michigan voters who are living overseas so that they can get their ballots, fill them out, and return them. And so there's that. So we're looking at like a couple of months at the earliest.
And then somebody goes in, they're in for a few months because we'll have elections in 2018.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that person will serve in all likelihood less than a year before they have to seek re-election, presuming they want to seek re-election. And of course, the election to look at in this congressional district, it's the most Democratic congressional district in Michigan. And so that means that the Democratic primary will determine really who holds the job.
That is Rick Pluta. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan Radio. Thanks, Rick.
You betcha.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The legislature is considering a package of bills that would give the state power to step in and manage a municipality's budget if the local government doesn't have a way to fully fund pension plans. That's a little more heavy-handed than a five-step plan a governor's task force recommended. Here to talk about that are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. Vicki, some police and firefighters rallied on the Capitol lawn this week against some of the aspects of this package of bills. If the intent is to safeguard their pensions, why are they opposed to this?
I think they're opposed to some of the processes being used to hamstring local governments in terms of funding the retiree health care portion as well as the pension. They want to protect it, want to make sure that cities don't go into bankruptcy and have to cut benefits that they were promised.
It looks like they could start chipping away at health care to save the pension. Is that what we're talking about?
I think that's part of what we're talking about, because it does require that if you do not fully fund or fund according to the levels required in the act that's being proposed, then a financial management system can come in and require more contributions by the employees for the healthcare portion. So it really takes a lot of the negotiating part of contracts out of the hands of local government.
Ken, underfunded pensions are a major problem for local governments. I should say the state has its own underfunded pension plan problems. How are these 16 bills the solution to the municipalities' problems?
Well, the legislation, and I think you got to give credit to Snyder and the legislature for how they've approached this as of late. I mean, a task force has documented the problem of unfunded liabilities at the local government level. They've made recommendations, and now you have legislation that's designed to correct the problem. Now, the legislation to some extent goes beyond some of the recommendations, but at the end of the day, this problem has to be solved. It's not going away. And at the end of the day, it's the retirees themselves who suffer the most if it isn't solved. But I think the crux of it is the legislation establishes kind of a five-step process all the way from transparency as to whether or not they're properly funded to the final step, which is for those handful of local governments that can't solve it, you do have a state three-member financial management team that will have pretty significant powers to kind of go in and correct the problem. And I think the controversy is going to be over that final phase and the powers of this three-member financial management team, because it smacks a little bit of kind of an emergency management situation.
I was going to say they have the right to sell assets a municipality owns or take control of the budget, but pretty much like an emergency manager. Now, I want to talk about the history. This is not a new problem. Governor Snyder, when he first came in 7 years ago, was saying, hey, we need to do something about that. And now they're really taking it seriously. How do we get to the point where both the state and municipal governments have these underfunded pensions? Vicki?
It's a historic problem of cutting taxes, Proposal A, which limits the amount of money that a city can collect in property taxes, combined with shifting revenue sharing away from local governments and really gutting their ability to fund these plans. I want to point out something good in the legislation, though. One of them is the ability now of a city to bond for these retirement benefits. I'm assuming the bonding that is allowable will be at a municipal rate instead of at a higher interest rate on the marketplace. That's a good thing if that's what's in here. There's also another problem. A lot of cities and local governments and states as well played loose and fancy with the paper funding. They used higher interest rates assumed for the investments, and so it looked on paper as if they were more funded than they actually were. And we're looking at the real numbers now, and that's the other good thing that's in this bill, is it requires you to look at the real numbers of funding.
Ken, when you were a majority leader in the Senate, how much of a concern was this? Were you guys looking at 20 years in the future and where these underfunded pension plans might be?
Lester, in my 20 years in the legislature from 1986 through 2006, I don't recall ever having a conversation of any length or substance over this issue. It really never rose to the surface. I think this problem of underfunded post-employment benefits kind of accelerated around 2008 and 2009. There was the Great Recession. You had revenue sharing cuts that occurred because of the state budget crisis. And then, as Vicki said, you know, the kind of the seeds of it were laid back in 1994 with Prop A. It put some limits on what local governments can do in terms of property taxes and et cetera. So I just think this problem really accelerated for those three reasons around 2008 and 2009. Not that it wasn't an issue prior to that, but it didn't appear to be a really major problem prior to that in Michigan.
I disagree a little bit with Ken there. The Government Accounting Standards Board issued new rulings in the early 2000s to address this problem with underfunding and required local governments in a phased-in basis to start accounting for their shortfalls. And so I remember as mayor in 2004 and 5, we started putting more money into our city's post-retirement benefit health care plan than we were actually putting into our retirement system. Other governments weren't as proactive, and that's when it fully came to a head with the crash and the Great Recession of 2008, where the shortfalls really started to show up.
You know, two things occur to me about this. The legislature is once again thinking about taking local government's authority away. And for some of the bills, the legislature has included appropriations, making it impossible for the people to take a referendum on the issue to the ballot. Fixing underfunded pension plans is important. But is it so important the state should take away local government's control of its budget and take away the right of the people to challenge an action by their state government?
No. I think the public has spoken very clearly on this issue of emergency managers and the state stepping in with such a heavy hand. And they originally turned down the emergency manager law, and then it was brought right back. And we've seen how effective it's been in the city of Flint and other communities where it's been applied.
Ken, what do you think?
My answer is yes and no. I do not agree with the idea of limiting the voters' ability to decide this at the ballot. However, the yes is that there are going to be occasions where the state is going to have to step in, hopefully limited, because a local government cannot or will not solve this problem. Now, as I look at their proposed solution, I think the Snyder administration and the legislature has actually learned something from Flint in that they create a three-member management team to grapple with this. This three-member team was actually a recommendation made by the Special Legislative Committee that looked at Flint, and also a recommendation from the Flint Water Advisory Task Force to have more than just one person step in and try to solve the problem.
Is the idea that there's a little back and forth and a little broader knowledge brought to the table? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, you have to have one member from the community on this team. You have to have somebody with local government experience on the team. You have to have somebody with financial management experience on the team, all of which are good things. And I wish they would amend the emergency manager law to do that for emergency managers across the board.
That's Ken Sikkema. He's a former Republican legislator, and he joined us by Skype. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks for taking the time to explain these underfunded pension bills to us.
It's a serious issue. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Roads, bridges, and other infrastructure in Michigan are in pretty bad shape. Michigan does not have the money to tackle some of the biggest projects. Increasingly, transportation officials are turning to the private sector for help. These public-private partnerships, often called P3s, are seen as a way to make improvements more efficiently. The real question, though, is whether they really are more efficient or whether they end up costing taxpayers more at the end of the day. Joining us to talk about that is Robert Fuentes. He's the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. That's a nonprofit think tank working on improving transportation policy. These public-private partnerships that come to mind, a couple of them, the Gordie Howe Bridge that's to span the Detroit River, linking Canada and the U.S., and several sections of I-75 in Oakland County. How do these P3s generally work?
The idea is for the public and the private sector to work together to develop a contract that is mutually agreeable to both the public and the private sectors to improve, build, or otherwise address a particular piece of infrastructure. They're often not cheaper. They're almost always going to be more expensive to go with the private partner. But the reason a public sector entity might go with a private partner is for several different reasons. They're trying to inject new kinds of innovation that the public sector may not have. They're trying to figure out ways to leverage additional funding that they may not have. Lots of different reasons. But the main thing is that you're trying to balance between the risks that these infrastructure projects may take and then the rewards that are generated from it. So mostly these P3 projects will have some kind of revenue-raising mechanism, such as a toll, that the private sector partner can take advantage of and actually make money from, and the public sector would get the benefit of having a new and improved piece of infrastructure.
Which is much like the international bridge we're talking about. Let's take a highway, for example. I mean, traditionally, government has sat down, they've designed, they've hired contractors, put bids out, they build it, and then the state or county maintains it. Exactly how is this different from that?
So for a new piece of infrastructure, and if you go with a public-private partnership or a P3 deal, the private sector absorbing the risk that goes along with it, some of the risk that goes along with it, such as construction delays or some kind of technological issues.
But isn't that the case already, though? Because contractors who don't get the job finished on time are docked some of the money that the government was going to pay them for the job. So I'm having a hard time getting my head around exactly what the difference is and why the private partnership is picking up some of this risk. How does that happen?
That's not always the case where that risk is transferred to the private partner. A lot of times you'll see the public partner have to absorb those kinds of cost overruns and things like that. And so this is really about how the contracts get structured up front. And in exchange for the private partner taking on more of that risk, they want some greater rewards. In many cases, it's the tolls or some kind of revenue that's generated from the traveling public.
With the private sector designing, building, maintaining, financing these projects in some of these cases, it seems that all that's left for the government to do is oversee and pay for them. One part of that, though, is the financing. I mean, generally speaking, government can get loans at a cheaper rate through issuing bonds. How can private sector keep the cost down if borrowing millions or tens of millions or more for a project costs more in interest?
In almost every case, it's going to be more expensive for the private sector because they're not able to take advantage of the cheaper financing that the public sector can take advantage of. And we've just gone through a period where public sector financing was at historic lows, almost down to 0% for some time. And so the challenge, though, we didn't see, even though rates were so low, we didn't see the public sector increase their borrowing in order to invest in infrastructure. There are a couple of reasons for that. Some places, you know, we just went through the recession, which hit a lot of states and localities very hard. They were still trying to replenish rainy day funds and things like that, and they were loath to take on more debt. Some places actually, during the recession, you know, hit up against their debt caps. Either they were self-imposed or legislatively imposed, and so they just didn't have the capacity to borrow anymore. And so we don't really know why it didn't happen, but people were starting to turn then to private partnerships as ways for alternative financing. Now, it's important to understand that this is not free money. It's always going to be more expensive. The public sector is giving something away, but in no case is this selling off of assets, right? The public sector always will retain ownership. It's really just the tools that are used to design, finance, build, and maintain the infrastructure over the long term.
Well, let's talk about maintenance. In this I-75 project in Oakland County, the private sector will patch the road, but the state will be responsible for things like snow removal. Are P3s good over the long term in a case where, I mean, do the private sector, they actually take care of the cracks and potholes in the long run?
It all depends on how you structure the contracts. You can easily see a situation where the contract is structured, which is very clear and lays out a precise, transparent maintenance schedule with rewards and penalties to the private sector for meeting objectives, for keeping the pavement in good shape, clearing roads and all that stuff. But it's all how the contract is structured and how well the public partner oversees that contract and holds the private partner accountable. And, you know, it may not always work perfectly, but there's no doubt that we do a pretty poor job with a public sector driven approach for maintaining infrastructure. We see this all across the country. Michigan is clearly an example of that. So how well the private partner maintains the infrastructure depends on the partner, and the enforcement is the result of what's in the contract.
What if that partner goes out of business or goes bankrupt? Is the state just left holding the bag for maintenance then?
Again, depends on how the contract is structured, but a great example is the Indiana Toll Road, just south of you guys. Governor Daniels famously put together a major transaction with a private partner to lease the toll road in Indiana. The private partner took it on. Through various reasons, the project went bankrupt, but because the contract was structured in such a way it held the state not responsible, the state got a lot of upfront money, $3+ billion for this transaction. The state got to keep that money, which it invested in transportation projects throughout the state. Once the company went bankrupt, the state took over control of the project, the road, again, and they rebid it out to a different partner. And so that's one great example. There are lots of examples, particularly when the United States first started to do these arrangements, where the public sector was stuck holding the bag in places in Virginia, California, some other cases. We've learned a lot more since then. and getting more precise and sophisticated about how the public and the private sector work together.
I read a story in Governing Magazine that indicated policymakers are not hearing from critics of P3s. I mean, they're holding hearings on public-private partnerships, but the voices of the critics are not heard or ignored. It's just the engineers with private firms, promises from private consortia, people who can gain from these public-private partnerships. What have you seen?
It's kind of a mix. I think there was a lot of suspicion, I would say, for a long time in this country, because we, by any measure, the United States is a laggard when it comes to engaging in these public-private partnerships. Other countries use this to a far greater degree than we do here in the United States, mostly because of the ability of public sector agencies and entities to take on low-cost financing. It's always cheaper for them to do it, and so we've always done it that way. But because things are changing now, because the investment needs are very large, because many places can't take on the debt, they're starting to look at these investments more. But there has been some suspicion. I think folks don't really recognize that this isn't selling off of assets. In almost every single case, the public sector and the government retains ownership of the asset. It's really just these relationships with the private partner to build, operate, maintain, or whatever it is. But now we're starting to get through a cycle where folks are starting to look at these much more. I think we know much more. We know that this, again, it isn't pure privatization, but nor is it something that is, it's not free money. It's going to cost money for the government, for the public partner in this case. And now you had the administration here in Washington talking very positively about these kinds of arrangements. In fact, this was seemed to be a linchpin behind what the Trump administration was starting to do to support this trillion-dollar infrastructure package they've promised. The president has started to kind of roll that back a little bit and say that he actually doesn't like these deals, so it's not entirely clear what's going to happen here in Washington. But there's no doubt that because of the amplified voice from the administration on these things, they've gotten more attention. What's going to happen in Washington is anybody's guess.
We've been speaking to Robert Puentes with the Eno Center for Transportation about the growing trend of P3s, that is public-private partnerships, to build major pieces of infrastructure such as interstate highways and bridges. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
Latinos en Michigan TV, la nueva opción informativa para la comunidad latina de Michigan.
That is the theme music introducing videos from Latinos in Michigan TV. It's a website and a YouTube channel that produces stories about events and issues around Michigan that might be of interest to Latinos and Hispanic people in the state. Our guest is the founder of Latinos in Michigan TV, Liliana Ospina. Welcome.
Thank you.
I understand this online video information service began as a hobby for you.
Yes.
Tell me why you chose video as a format.
In Colombia, I used to be a reporter, and I used to have the cameraman and videos. And I really enjoy doing videos because it's easy to tell the story through videos. And most people now use social media. Most immigrants use their Facebook. And so for me, it was easier to show the stories using videos. And, you know, I started researching.
But this started out basically as something you did in your spare time. And these days you're traveling over a good part of the state. You're doing interviews. You're shooting video. I understand you take the family along on trips sometimes.
Yes.
How well does that all work?
Well, they know that when I'm doing my interviews, they had to be quiet. And they are used to it. They just sit in a corner, either with a tablet or with a book. And they know that it won't take a long time. And I'll do it, and they are happy with me. And I also do it because I wanted to show my kids that there are different realities. They live in this reality, which is I'm their mom. They have their house in Howell. But there are other families in other parts of the state that don't live as we do. And I don't want them to take what they have for granted.
I just want to note, one of your kids is in here. Well, your daughter is in here. She's being very quiet in the separate studio. And I think you should be proud because that doesn't happen very often. I want to ask you about the kind of stories you're covering, because I saw a lot of different things on the channels. What's your priority? What things are you wanting to get to your audience?
When I moved to Michigan, I used to be, like I said, I used to be a reporter in Colombia, so I was like, oh, I can be a reporter in Michigan. But there are not Hispanic media outlets or TV media outlets in Michigan. And during the time I've been living here, I had seen a lot of stories of people that had been abused or have been having issues with immigration. And I think that's what really matters to Hispanic community, immigration, sources to get community, you know, help. So that's what I focus. Like, I contact nonprofit organizations that help illegal immigrants to get support on immigration, to get information about resources for them or their families. I also had contact Haven, which is a shelter for domestic abuse women. In a few years ago, I used to be an advocate for domestic abuse women. And
so all important stories. But you also do some things. Like I saw one of them was about student photography exhibit in Southwest Detroit at Clark Park. That was kind of interesting. The kids were at with a bunch of cameras at the Ren Fair, the Renaissance Fair in Michigan. So you do a few lighter things occasionally too.
Yes, because this story I really like because the coordinator of this program, she's the daughter of immigrants, and she, when she was little or younger, she started taking photography and she got some scholarships and became an artist and a photographer. And now she's giving back to the community, helping children in a after school program. She got a grant and got professional photography. And she's teaching them, you know, to take good photographs. And now they start an exhibition in Clark Park in Detroit. I was just there. And that exhibition is going to show the work of her students and also it's going to help them to get funding if they sell their pictures. So it's like a positive story, not just immigration.
I read that there are nearly a half million Spanish-speaking people in Michigan. What kind of viewership are your videos getting?
In YouTube, the irony is that I had the biggest YouTube channel among Hispanic media, like compared to other Hispanic channels. I have more people, but I don't have thousands. I only have like 400.
That's pretty significant. That's more than my videos get.
But on Facebook, when I upload the videos, it could be from 1,400 views to 6,000. So it's not like huge, like some people get videos and it's 40,000. No, but it's significant.
So how unique is your service, Latinos and Michigan TV, in Michigan? Are there other media services serving the Hispanic population?
There are a lot of Hispanic media outlets don't do original content. They focus here in things that come from Mexico, and everything is general. And with me, I focus on create stories that identify the reality of Hispanics. And that's what I go everywhere to show them that there are a lot of people doing good things for them. Right now, you know, last year with the political environment, everybody was so afraid of immigration, of the ICE. And that's what I did a lot of videos telling them, okay, these are your rights, this is what you should know. And then with that information, it helps them sometimes to empower them first and also allows them not to be victims of scams. A lot of people, oh, I'm going to take advantage of this person because he doesn't know the language, he's illegal. But when they have that information, they know they are not alone, that they can get information and get a help from other organizations. And I think that's my mission, that if you are an immigrant, either illegal or not, sometimes when you come to a state like Michigan, everything is so hard because there are a lot of Hispanics. So in my case, I came here 12 years ago, and it was so depressing because I left everything, and the Hispanic community is smaller and it's very scattered. But it's like that, like, okay, you are here, and there are more people like you, and there are places that can help you and provide you help and information to get ahead, because a lot of immigrants come here to get a better life. But Latinos in Michigan TV has opened doors for me, and I think for me it's like my hobby, but also I'm giving back to the community because I'm giving them information that otherwise they would not have. So
That's not a hobby. That's a mission.
I guess.
So where do you want to take Latinas and Michigan TV? What do you want it to become?
I would love the channel to be bigger and, you know, to reach more people. I wanted to get funding to go to the Upper Peninsula, but I couldn't get a grant. So I want to reach more because I usually drive a lot. Today I went to Flint to interview some people. Then I come here. Sometimes I go to Detroit. So I would love to have more coverage. And like I said, this is my hobby. I'm not making any money on it. But it's opening doors for me to do other things, and I'm grateful for that.
Liliana Ospina is the founder of Latinos and Michigan TV, an online video information service for Michigan's Hispanic communities. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Think back to grade school. Remember that one kid who was always disrupting the class, talking out of turn, cracking jokes, didn't seem to understand how to behave appropriately in class, always getting sent to the principal's office, a real troublemaker? Well, there's a new book called Troublemakers, Lessons in Freedom from Young Children at School. The author is Carla Shalaby. She's a research specialist at the School of Education at the University of Michigan, and she joins us now. These troublemakers that you describe in your book, Zora, Lucas, Sean, and Marcus, we really get to know these kids, know their teachers, even know their families a little bit. And by the way, I think at least three of them would make really good journalists because they just pursue information doggedly. Let's talk about how you found these kids.
Yeah, so these kids are never really that hard to find, and you can find at least one in every single kind of classroom in every single kind of school. But I work in teacher education, and so I have the great privilege of being in classrooms all over the country and all over the place and often, which even teachers don't really get the privilege of seeing so many different kinds. And so I was working supporting new teachers in those classrooms. And, of course, those students stand out everywhere I go. And so I was drawn to them while just doing classroom observations of the student teachers who were actually placed in their rooms. But they came recommended by their teachers. Their teachers were asked for students who just seemed to, like you said, just kind of doggedly pursue their own interests.
The one thing I wasn't clear about is how long were you in those classrooms?
Yeah, so it was about a full year with a couple of them a little bit longer than that. And so, of course, as you know from reading the book, it was seeing them both in school, but trying to see them outside of school as much as possible as well. So at their karate classes and baseball practice and all of their out of school time.
And even went into therapy sessions with the family sometimes.
Yes.
I think it would be difficult for most of us to view these kids from your perspective. I mean, you have a lot of empathy for these kids, but you know, their behavior is irritating. I mean, really, really disruptive. How was it that you were able to look beyond that and get to the point that you believe they're like caged birds who need to fly, need to sing?
I think there are a couple of ways. One, I think I have quite a bit of empathy for them just in terms of the way that I was positioned in a school as well. So when I was a school teacher, I often felt like the troublemaker, and I felt really unpleasantly sort of received by my administrators for making noise about the kinds of things that I thought were wrong. And so I already had the experience of feeling like behaviors are unwelcome when they are difficult or critical or challenging to authority. So I had empathy on that level. But the other way is that, frankly, when you're a teacher and especially an elementary school teacher, you do learn over time to see children as full human beings. I think if you're committed to that profession, that empathy is part of both your training and your daily practice. So I think I was already a bit wired that way.
I want to get a little further into that, what you just said about that, but let's deal with some other things first. I think when you have a troublemaker, the instinct, I think, among most adults is to try to minimize the disruptive behavior because you don't want the other kids to suffer. You don't want them to lose out on learning opportunities because of that one kid or a couple of kids. What do you say about that to teachers or parents of those kids who are not the troublemakers?
Yeah, that's always the hardest question because I do understand that the way we respond to troublemakers typically can mean that we're taking opportunities away from other kids. But I would say that's more about our response than it is about the troublemaking behaviors themselves. So teachers will often say, and families will often say, well, that, you know, this behavior is standing in the way of my kid's opportunity to learn. What I always say is actually that child is providing your child an opportunity to learn. Maybe not the kinds of things that we typically think
not
are the only
plan
things
of that
should
day,
be taught
right.
in school, but it's an opportunity to learn quite a bit about how to treat people as if they are important and how to see them and how to hear them and how to see and hear them despite behaviors that are quite unpleasant. I think that's a habit that we could all afford to learn.
In the book, there were times when it was really difficult for you to just be an observer. After all, I mean, as you mentioned, you're a former teacher. How successful were you in being close to these four kids without being an influence on them and kind of messing up your research?
You know, it's amazing because I have never felt so free in a classroom as I was as an adult who did not have a teaching responsibility. And I have to say, I'm not sure I would have been able to know these kids in the same way if I did have the responsibility for teaching them. I was able to just genuinely be curious about them and not have to try to intervene. That was just the most liberating experience. And I wish more teachers had the chance to be with the kids that they teach in a genuinely curious way without the pressure to have to move them somewhere and intervene and change them in a million different ways. And so I feel like these are the kids, of all the kids I've taught, who I know the best, as a matter of fact, because I could just wonder about them rather than having to obsess over how to change them.
Of those kids, I believe it was Marcus who really tried to draw you in, though. He was really trying to get you to some exchange with him. How did that feel?
You know, I have to tell you, I love all four of these kids, but I probably think about Marcus the most. I feel that I was the most connected to Marcus, even though actually I saw him the least out of all four of those kids as well. Because he was really adept at human connection. He had a skill and a talent for it, and I just fell in love with him in a different kind of way. And so, yeah, of course, the book argues that that's the major thing that he was working for in his negative behavior. But it was, of course, hard to resist, and he's probably the one that I intervened on the most in terms of a teaching role. But he made that not optional for me, and I think for that reason, I often think about him the most.
When you describe the behavior of the kids in the classroom, it's one thing. But then you tell us about what they're like at home. And suddenly there's a big, at least for me, there was a big paradigm shift. I'm like, oh, I get this now. In what ways did their home lives help you understand them? And let's just single out one of them. For example, Zora.
Yeah. I can't begin to describe how much seeing her at home changed my view of who she was at school and helped me to understand what she was doing at school and why. And so, of course, you know, Zora is a biracial child. She's Puerto Rican and African American and is one of the very few in her school children of color and is positioned, you know, as really problematic for being different. And yet at home,
she's sort of a free spirit.
That's an understatement. Yeah. She loves to stand out. That is a part of who she is. And of course, school is not really a place for that. School is a place for fitting in, for
conformity,
being like,
yeah.
And well-intentioned conformity. Her teachers are really well-intentioned and cared about her quite a bit. But it was conformity with a particular way of being. And that was a white middle-class way of being that they thought was the world that they were trying to prepare her for. At home, she was being prepared quite differently for the world as her parents of color saw it. And her parents of color understood that she needed quite a bit of pride in the things that made her different. And so they played up her differentness. You know, they played up her outstandingness. And it was celebrated. And they're all really unusual people in some ways, right? They stand out. You're going to notice her parents in a room. You're going to notice her grandma.
Why? Why would you notice them?
They're amazing. They're colorful. They're bold, bright. They're loud. They are just people who are like celebrating life and are just very much awake and alive. You see them. You're just not going to miss them. But their clothes, their manner of speech, just the way that they be in the world is a noticeable way of being. And it's quite infectious, but it's very, very different than their neighbors and than all of the people who are in their very wealthy sort of neighborhood. So they stand out and they take pride in their standing out and they figure, well, we stand out here anyway as people of color in a very, very predominantly white neighborhood. We might as well sort of take it all the way. But at school, you know, that way of being was not the way. And really caused Zora quite a bit of trouble at school.
Your premise, as I understand it, is these kids, these troublemakers, are not really the problem. Actually, they're the canary in the coal mine. In what way?
They're drawing our attention to some of the invisible kinds of poisons in our classroom and school air. And so the way that I understand what they're doing is that, you know, they are refusing to accept things and to comply with things that frankly may not be good for any of the children in that room, but the other children may just be able to live with it more quietly. And so I think sometimes what's hardest for teachers is that some of the harm that we do to children is really quite invisible to us because it's well-intentioned, because we take for granted that these are things that are okay, because we know we care about kids. And so that invisibility makes those kinds of poisons really hard to intervene on because you don't see them as a teacher. So my sense is that if a kid is really triggered by something in a classroom enough to persist on bad behavior despite all of the ways that it's going to negatively affect that child, that's drawing our attention to something. There's a trigger that we can't see that child is bold enough to respond to. And so we'd better wonder what that's a response to. And I think we wonder about that in the wrong set of ways typically. And we search for problems in the child rather than thinking, What's the trigger here in the cultural and social air of our classrooms?
And, of course, the way we punish them is, Sure. Okay, you go sit at the back of the classroom, Yes. They miss out on a lesson plan. You go to the principal's office, they miss out on more schooling. You are suspended or expelled, they miss out on more schooling. That's not really helping out. No. So what do you suggest?
Well, it's certainly not helping that child. But to go back to your earlier question, I think it's also not helping the other children in the room. The other children are learning something from us when that is how we respond to behavior that is unusual or challenging or difficult. To exclude a person teaches the other children that person is disposable and that we can make our lives easier by just removing that person from our community. I think that is a hard lesson for the other kids to learn.
Yeah, and it sounds like incarceration too.
Well, that is what it is. That's what it's preparation for. It's preparation for the world that we have now, which says if you do something bad, you deserve to be thrown away and that's your choice. And that's a decision that you've made. In fact, no, that's a cultural response to transgression. And actually, we all move through the world doing harm. And we need to think about different ways to respond to the ways that we do harm, because I'm hoping that teachers understand the opportunity they have to teach for the world that we want rather than the world that we have.
Of course, we get to know some of these teachers as well.
Yes.
And all well-intentioned, as you said. But, you know, you're kind of at the end going, okay, well, what's the lesson here? What can you do? You didn't leave teachers hanging. You offer some advice. Can you sum it up in a couple of sentences?
I tried not to leave teachers hanging, even though I know we'll probably still be somewhat dissatisfying because it is not a how-to book. Mm-hmm. And this is a book, you know, to your earlier point around the incarceration comparison. Like, I've really been reading a lot about a movement afoot around the abolition of prisons and the abolition of police. What would a world look like if we didn't need police and we didn't need prisons? I think about that a lot, and I wonder about what are the skills that world would require? And so what would we need to be able to do in relation to each other in the imagination of a world that didn't require us to cage human beings no matter their transgressions? I've started to try to mine that work for the actual skills that we might begin to teach young children. Different ways of being with each other that are insistent on every person mattering and no person being disposable. I think that's actually a set of relational skills that we can teach in school. Usually the response is, yeah, okay, but what about math? What about literacy, right? I think of math and literacy as, you know, again, just tools and a set of skills that help us to imagine and to enact a different and a better and a more human world.
But the thing that we hear,
yeah,
and I've heard this several times by politicians in Lansing, is that, look, we have to train a better workforce. And that means you got to be in work on time. You got to behave a certain way at the workplace. You got to be at your machine at a certain point, and that requires rigidity. That's not what you're talking about here.
That isn't what I'm talking about. That is a description of the world we have now, where people are defined by their work and where we build schools in the image of a job market, where it's sort of every person for themselves. But, you know, we live in a state where there are people who don't have clean water to drink, right? That's the result of that kind of model of thinking, well, it's every person for themselves and we ought not worry about throwing people away. Right? I think what I'm trying to work toward is preparing children not just for work, but for work that helps them to be in relation with each other in different kinds of ways. So we ought to not just prepare kids for work, but also prepare them to be parents, prepare them to be good partners, prepare them to be good colleagues when they're at work. Relationships with other people are not secondary to job skills. They're central to job skills.
The book is Troublemakers, Lessons in Freedom from Young Children at School. The author is Carla Shalaby. Thanks for telling us about Zora, Lucas, Sean, and Marcus. I don't think your readers are going to forget them.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. We are at The Last Word, a craft cocktail bar in Ann Arbor. So why are we here?
Well, one, because it's my cheers. Sometimes you want to go where
everybody knows your name. Oh, right.
And two, to have a great holiday cocktail that is one of your and my favorites.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
That's right. It's called the Mulling Around Town, and it was created by the principal bartender here at The Last Word, whose name is Giancarlo Aversa.
And he chose his name. Hi.
So, Giancarlo, tell us about what inspired this drink.
It's a cocktail based off of the Boulevardier, which is a cocktail based off of the Negroni. It's a simple cocktail that has three parts. And those parts for the Negroni are gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari. And for the Boulevardier, it is bourbon, sweet vermouth, and Campari.
So how did you give this a holiday feel?
Well, playing off of the idea of like a mulled wine or using those seasonal spices, mulled spice, I just simply took mulling spices and steeped them in my bourbon.
Nice.
Now, you guys are talking about Campari. For those of us who don't know what that is, where does that come from?
Campari is an Italian ingredient. It's one of a class of bittersweet Italian liqueurs that when they're served before dinner are called aperitivos and after dinner are called digestivos. And they all have some bitter elements along with some sweet elements. And Campari is bracingly bitter. Campari is definitely not for everyone, but once you acquire a taste for it, it's delicious.
Well, I like it. I mean, I've had it before, and I've had this cocktail, Giancarlo, and when I first had it, gosh, a year or two ago,
sure,
I thought,
yeah,
this is really, really wonderful. It just feels like the holidays to me. So how do you make this?
Well, you just, like I said before, you take your mulling spice and you steep it in bourbon. You can pick up mulling spice at Whole Foods, or if you have a dry goods store in your neighborhood, I'm sure they would have that.
So about how much do you use and how long does it take?
I would take a tablespoon of mulling spice for every cup of bourbon and let that sit for about an hour. And if that's flavorful enough, separate the mulling spice from the bourbon. And if you want it a little bit more, let it go for another hour. But I wouldn't go too much longer than 2 hours. Then, once that's steeped, you separate the mulling spice from the bourbon using a fine mesh strainer, put it back in the original container, and you're ready to mix your cocktail. It's equal parts, 1 ounce of the mulled bourbon, 1 ounce of sweet vermouth, and 1 ounce of Campari. You put that in a mixing glass, add ice, and give it a good stir for about 30 seconds, and pour it into your vessel of choice.
As you know, this is our Michigan-themed cocktail, so you, of course, are a Michigan bartender, but I know you also used a Michigan ingredient here.
Correct. We used the Traverse City whiskey for our bourbon in that one, and that plays very nicely with its flavor and pairs with the spices of the mulling spice that are very seasonal.
Let's have a little sip of it. Oh, it's just like I remember it.
Christmas in a glass.
It really is.
Cheers.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. And one quick note, the show today featured a couple of interviews that aired earlier this year on Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.